Thanks, everyone. I'm not quite sure where to stand. There's a lot of you. Thanks very much for coming. As Sam said, I came here and did my undergraduate fine arts in 1979. And so I was here for 3 years, so I know what it's like to be a student here. And I think things have changed a lot, but basically I am living proof that you can survive as an artist, just. But yeah, so somehow over the years I've managed to actually be an artist. And of course I've had to do lots of other jobs to keep going. But one of those jobs led me into being able to study history, and I came back to do cultural heritage here so that I could work with history. And so often in my work there's a bit of an overlap between things that I find interesting, contemporary history, and often if I'm organising some kind of exhibition about history, I'll try and bring strategies from the visual arts into that museum world. And so there are a lot of strategies that we use as artists. Repetition, you can see some of them happening here today. You know, sort of working with poetry rather than didactic stuff. There's a whole lot of things that we can talk about that I think make history more interesting. So I try and bring some of that stuff that I learnt into museums if I ever get the chance. So this project here, I think I'll just say a little bit, and then if you've got any questions, you know, please ask me. I'm a painter normally. That's where my passion is. But I've been also working. You know how as an artist, you kind of you do the stuff that you're good at and you really like doing, but you also fiddle around with all these other little things. You go on these little tangents. Well, one of those tangents was collecting book covers. And I got that because I went to Madrid, and in Madrid they have special shops for book binding. And it's amazing. As Australians, we cannot even comprehend that, right? But Spanish people have a lot of old books and they regularly get them rebound. And I went past this shop and they were just chucking out all these old book covers, which were covered in vellum, which is cow skin, right? And they were 100, 200 years old, and they were just being chucked out. So I managed to get some of those and reclaim them and use them in some projects well over 15 years ago. And now I always think about book covers as a kind of entry point into a culture. So when I went to Ireland, I tried to find book covers to work on over there. And of course, Ireland is such a wet place that a lot of the old books got mouldy. So it was actually quite difficult for me to find old book covers there. So it's one of the things that I do. I just like to work, almost sketch, I guess, on old book covers. But so about a year and a half ago, I was involved in the Row 8 protest. I'm sure some of you have heard of that. And at the end of that, I collected all the archives. So I collected all the things from the protest, and I had nowhere to put them. And interestingly enough, someone from the Army Museum said, you know what, you can put them in some boxes in a shed out the back of the Army Museum. So I was out there one day, and in this shed, you know, we're scavengers, aren't we? Come on, as artists, you know, we love to scavenge things. And there was all these boxes, boxes and boxes. And I'm like, what's in these boxes? And the guy out there said, oh, they're just old books. Now, that was like gold, right? So I'm into these boxes, looking at the books. And the first one I found was Stuka Pilot. This one here, I sort of picked up Stuka Pilot, which is pretty old, pretty wrecked. And I thought, God, that's a great title, you know. And then I realized that in these boxes were like thousands, really, of books all about war. Like every single book was about war. And I said, where are these from? And he said, oh, these are from the old army barracks. And they were the officer's library. So anyone that was an officer in the Defence Forces would have used this library. And some of the books date back to before the First World War, the Second World War, and Chris has actually found one from 1877. So they were fascinating in themselves, and I said, what's going to happen to them? And he said, well, they're just going to go to landfill. You know, they're just going to be chucked out. They're just waiting here. It was like the waiting room of death before they were going to get chucked out. And so I was pretty horrified and he said, look, you can take them or you can pay $5 a box. So I went back about five times, and in the end I think I took 400 books home. And, you know, as artists we are discriminating. That's one of our things that we learn, to be discriminating. And being discriminating is actually quite a good thing to be able to do sometimes. So we make choices. So I started to make choices either on the title, which I found interesting, or when the works popped, you know, in terms of colour theory, you've got green and red here, you've got opposite colours happening. And I realised pretty quick that some curator, or some librarian, I should say, had taken off very carefully, spent months taking off the paper covers. Can I just use that for a second? Of each book, you can see here there's one of the paper covers, which are beautiful in themselves, and replaced them, thank you, with a cut-out piece of canvas. So individually cut out each one of these red canvases and stuck them on. And I don't know why. I've spoken to a few librarians, and it's just whether it was to stop people handling the, you know, pulling the books out, or whether it was so they could write another number on them, we're not really sure. And but as an artist, of course, those became incredibly interesting aspects. And I realised that with all the marks on the work, on each title, on each book cover, there were so many different marks. Marks of handling, marks of use, marks by the librarian. There were text marks, numbers. There was marks of people's hands, you know, the many, many people that have read these books. And so I didn't really have to do anything as an artist. My job really was to say, I am just going to draw attention to these marks and how beautiful they are, how interesting they are. And so then I started to think, how can I use the books? Because I'm sure you've seen many, many artists use books, and it can be a bit of a cliche. You know, it can be, you can go, oh, that's a great idea, but how innovative is it? How interesting is it really? And I started to look at other artists. So I did a lot of research on other artists that use books and other artists that had looked at collections, because really it's not so much that they're books, it's that it's a collection of war books. And so it has its own meaning because it's a collection. So if it was just random books, it would be interesting, but not as interesting as having a whole lot of books that were specifically collected to be about war. So that's the kind of heaviness to it, I guess, that I wanted to look at as well. I started to play with all the books, as we do, and think about, you know, I loved putting different ones together, you know, to see what happened with the colours together. But also, I realised some of them, you know, were... The titles were interesting, but you had to get up really close to look at them. So I'd have to come up with a strategy that took that into account. There's a great book here. Unfortunately, it's rubbed off, but the title is The Men in My Life, which I think was written by a war journalist. And so I realised pretty quickly that I wanted that one in there, but I couldn't really... I had to think of a way that would make people read the titles. So... One, you know, if you're looking at a good painting operates on a couple of different levels. You have to look at a painting and immediately see it from a distance. It has to work from a distance. But also it has to work when you got really close to it. So I guess I started to look at this work as a painting. I started to think of a way of having long lines of the books so that people could walk along and read them. And in some of my other work, I've done a lot of work about ships. I don't know if you heard of the High Tide Festival that we had in Fremantle last year, but I projected the names of ships from the port up onto the Port Authority building, and just their titles, you know, Genius Highway and all the Aces. And I'm sure you've seen some of the ships' names. They're like little poems. And I guess I'm really entranced by titles and where words have random other meanings or poetic meanings, and of course these titles do as well. So I've got this love of ships and the idea of working with ships. So I initially thought of having a warship as my shape, and how many books could I fit in that warship. But when I looked around Perth, trying to find somewhere that I could beg to please let me put up this warship, this wall, if you can see here, this wall has only been up for a little while, but it really jumped out, and I thought, wow, this would be a great place. This wall would be a great place to put an installation of the books. So I approached Chris and said, you know, what do you think? And he said, well, yeah, I think it's okay, but what about the warship? Have you thought of a submarine shape? And I had, but I didn't have one. I had no real connection to a specific submarine, and he suggested the AE-1, which... He suggested that because just around the corner is the Hive, and the Hive is where they're doing 3D photography of the Sydney and the AE-1. So they've taken thousands of photographs underwater of the actual AE-1, and you can see more of that later. I think I'll have are they going to have a display up, Chris, of that later on? Yeah. So you can see that's the real submarine there that they've... But you can't just take a photo like that. That's, you know, hundreds of photographs put together to make that. And he's actually made a 3D render. So you've got high technology happening here in the digital world talking about the AE-1. And then you've got old school, the physical nature of something that's saying something else about the AE-1. And the idea of the AE-1 is just so beautiful because it was... lost for 103 years. So it's special because it's talking about memory. It was lost in people's memory, although some people remembered it and searched for many, many years. They didn't forget. They searched and searched until they found it. And they found it last year. So there's something really beautiful about that. And the idea of a submarine being submerged, being sunk, and this whole library being sunk, you know, there was no hope for this library. Nobody wanted it. So I guess it really was perfect for me then to use the AE-1 as a shape, as a holder for the idea of the books. So when Chris said, yes, you can go ahead, then I was able to plan it and I was able to get funding from DCA. So I approached them for funding and luckily got some money to make it, because behind the books is a whole very well-made wooden backing. So that wooden backing had to be designed. So Xavier, who works here, is a fantastic designer, and he designed it on a CAD computer. So we found the shape of the AE-1, and he then fitted it to the wall and made a CAD drawing, which was then given to my brother, who is a wooden boat builder by chance, and he was able to build the sections. So each section has got a wooden panel behind it. There's about 13 sections, and the conning tower sits on the top. So it had to be designed so that it would be on the wall, being able to slot together like this, so each panel slot together. And it had to be designed so it wasn't too... each panel wasn't too big, so that I could carry it. So at home, I just work in a double garage, and I had a table set up, and I would just put the two panels at a time, put them together so that I could work in a kind of jigsaw effect. You can see this is obviously where one of the panels finishes. You can sort of see it if you look very closely, where two panels are slotting together. But the idea is to sort of hide it a little bit so you have the illusion of the whole thing. So I worked on them at home, and I didn't really see it up like this until it was actually installed, because I don't have a 15-metre long wall. So that really is the story. So on top of the wood, each one of these books has been very gently murdered, in a sense. Like, I had to take them apart. So even though I wanted to save them, I had to cut the book out, the actual book part out. I decided that I would save the front pieces. And in these old books, they were designed to have this front piece, and often new books don't have it anymore. I think it's considered a waste of space. But there's something really beautiful about these front pages, just the title. And when you see them up like that, each one, you know, it takes you into another story. But each one is a little poem on its own. But I wanted to... They also remind me of tombstones, in a sense. So they're... and the colours, and talking about the quality of the paper, because after the war, paper was very, you know, there wasn't a lot of money, people couldn't spend money on books, and so they were on pretty cheap paper, which is good for me because it means the paper is, it has almost a photo kind of quality where it's faded and got those beautiful colours, you know, that talk about age. I've still got lots of books left over, so I'm bringing some in and giving them away. A lot of the really good ones have gone. They were like, you know, German books and all lots of books about Hitler. And I've tried to divide the colours up, divide the themes up, because you can see there's a lot of themes. There's nuclear weapons. There's a whole lot of books about nuclear weapons. There's a whole lot of book about Japan being a menace, so Asia and what happened during the war, which is quite interesting now. You probably wouldn't get some of these titles now because they'd be considered pretty racist. So, you know, this one, I Married a German, that's quite... a lot of people find that funny, but, you know, whether you'd have that title now, I don't know. So I think that's all. I'd rather sort of answer questions if you have any.
I'm the faculty librarian here for In Humanities. And just to answer your question about why book covers are removed, my understanding is it's for ease of use. So anything loose on the book, if you're handling it lots of times, they become lost and they just get in the way of machinery and things. Mm-hmm. So that's my understanding of why they are removed. It does make the book a lot more uninteresting, I guess, to look at, but it has to be a functional
aspect. So. Yeah. That's true, and we did actually, whoever did it very carefully put those covers and stuck them inside the book cover. So underneath a lot of these book covers is the actual paper version, and we did manage to save everyone we could, and a friend of mine's got those, and I could have put them up as a third work because they are incredible, but they would have really dominated because they're very dramatic and they're very interesting and colourful and really amazing. They would have really dominated the installation.
But there's probably potential to use those in other ways as well.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah, they're fantastic. The old 50s and 60s book covers are really, really beautiful. I'm so glad that a librarian came because, you know, at the moment, I think one of the other things is that so many books are being chucked out, even from our libraries, and it's tragic. It really is. I think as artists we have, you know, we need to, it's a shame that there's not a sign on them that says free for artists because, you know, we can always make use of books. I know at the State Library I found out that they were being chucked out and they're in a skip bin out the back. So I actually got in the skip bin, I think it was 40 books about history. So it was like the death of history surrounding me in my car, and I've still got all those books at home, and I would love to make another work about the death of history, the way that we're chucking out books, you know, left, right and centre.
We are currently undergoing a similar thing in the library. It's not as extensive as other places are, but what we're doing is taking any multiple copies that we've got, so we make sure we're keeping one, but we're making them available to students down on the entry level. So
right.
The books are out on shelves and they are available to take.
Great. Good on you. That's great. That's much better than sticking them in the bin out the back. That's great. Yeah, so I hope you guys can go and get them because I think what's interesting, though, about these ones is that they're of a period of time too, and... You know, the thing of, they'll be digitised, everything's being digitised. Well, I doubt whether Stuka Pilot is going to be digitised. A lot of these books were written by people who, you know, probably the only book they ever wrote, they would have spent a couple of years of their life writing the book, and it was usually about their friends, their battalion that died, or they were the last one left, or, you know, their experiences during the war, very personal experiences, and... some of them were probably pretty bad books, you know, they're probably pretty boring or pretty weirdly written. But they wrote them, and there's a one page of text over there that talks about why these books were written. And they were written by people who were desperate for the generations coming along afterwards to not forget. Please don't ever let this happen again, lest we forget. So that's why they wrote these books. And so there's a terrible, heartbreaking irony in them being chucked out. Because, of course, they have been forgotten. And when I found these books, it was when Trump and North Korea, when that whole thing was blowing up. And I thought, oh, God, here we go again. You know, we so easily talk about using nuclear weapons, and yet there is the end of the world there staring us in the face if we do. So it's kind of crazy. Yeah. So that it's been an important project for me on a kind of personal level, just to make an anti-war statement, but in a way that talks about how we, if we lose books, we also lose that connection to our bodies and our, and therefore our humanity, you know. I don't really like Kindles. I think they're a great idea, but I don't really like them because I like to handle a book that other people have handled. I love that idea that a friend's given me the book, or I'm giving someone the book, or our whole family's read the book, or, you know, I love that. But that's just me. What do other people think about books? Are they kind of irrelevant to your life? Like, do you think, oh, yeah, I should read a book, but you actually never do?
There are many that don't necessarily read them. They're artifacts in themselves.
Yeah.
And as you say, I can't bring myself to throw a book away, so we don't read them. Because it's an artifact, like I say, it's a recording, somebody's recording. Still whole, it's still valuable, it carries into the future.
I don't think you can keep every book, you know. I don't want to be a hoarder and have too many books, but there's a fine balance there, I think.
I think I like books because they take up space. I mean, I do like it that, you know, you think about a single screen, that you can only see it in one page per screen. Mm-hmm. You can't spread out, or you can't sort of have a number of things open unless you start to actually increase the number of screens.
Yeah.
The idea that something physical can sort of hold in your hand, it weighs something, it can be put over here, left open.
I'm with you. There's something amazing about books, and I can't believe that, you know, you actually have to say it. Like, you know, people keep saying, "Oh, read my essay on the screen now." You know, they'll send you something, a link to read their essay. I can hardly bear to make myself read someone's essay on the screen anymore. I want to, but I'd prefer to read it in a hardcover now. I've kind of gone away from the screen. Maybe I'm just terribly old-fashioned, I'm not sure, but I love books and, yep.
Jo, I think I was put in a similar position to you where I found a library destined for landfill. And the library that I found was owned by the Latvian community. And these books were all brought over after World War II. A lot of displaced people found themselves in Australia and clinging to culture, imported books in Latvian and kept them. And people lovingly and carefully cut out newspaper articles from the time and kept them inside the cover, thinking, you know, one day in the future someone's going to care about this. And a lot of them were written by people who had been displaced or had horrific experiences during the war that resulted in these things. And much like you were saying, the fear that people would forget or move on drove amateur writers to write these stories, and now in 2018 it turns out no one does care and that the books will end up in landfill. And I, like you...
You do care.
I have them in my house, and I have a whole Latvian library in my house, which I've also turned into various artworks over this last 12 months. But it's the end. And how do you reconcile yourself with it being the end for these objects? And, I mean, I don't know if it's because I'm Latvian and I feel like, in a way, the end of this and allowing them to go for or allowing them to die is like the death of the story of my grandparents, my Omit and Orpitz, and their harrowing journey. But their harrowing journey is not special because it's the same harrowing journey that most migrants have and you have done this very brave and bold thing where you've got these books and you've cut them, and as you say, you've murdered them to signify the end of this. And it's just so brave.
Don't do that with the Latvian library. Okay?
I have this immense admiration for it. And I'm actually hoping to figure out a way to get them back to Latvia, because I think that they are more useful there than they are here. But how do you...
That's interesting.
How have you reconciled yourself with the end, the murder?
Well, that is actually a really interesting point. I got a few friends, and I have actually acknowledged them in here, because I got some friends that also love books, and we sat down at the table, and it took us weeks, you know, working together. We'd work together one day a week, and I'd have a box of books, and we'd look at them, we'd look at each book, we'd have a pile. This book, who can we give it to? This book, I'd go, no, I really want that one. For this, mainly to do with colour or a really good title. Or this book is too good. I don't know what to do with it yet, but it's going to stay in that pile because we cannot kill that book. I gave away hundreds of books to people. They'd come around to my house and I'd say, do you want this book? Do you want a book about this or that? And you know, when you say no one cares, actually, I think people do care. But I think that the powers that be, the librarian in this case at the barracks, it just got too hard. They didn't know what to do, and I think they didn't try hard enough. They said, oh, we can't sell them at Legacy because they're too wrecked. We can't sell them. So when something doesn't have a commercial value, a lot of people don't know what to do with it. But I've found that people do care, and I put them out here so that people can take them, and people have already taken, you know, 30 books. So, but it's interesting. I don't know. I had a really hard time cutting the books. I tried to give them away to another artist friend, Purdy. I don't know if you know Purdy. She works with termites. So she was looking for books so her termites could eat the books. So she got a lot, but there's only so many her termites can eat. So we had piles and piles that just went. I tried to compost them, but it turns out books take a long time to break down pages. So a lot of them just went into recycling, the inner part of the books. Yeah, it was really hard. I was aware of the strange irony of... But I had to do something.
I'm glad that you found it really difficult as well, that makes me feel better about being so emotional about it all.
It's really emotional. It was really heartbreaking. And afterwards, some of them I've really regretted, because there's one here, this one, it says, Fate is the Hunter. And I've been putting the little titles up on Instagram. So I have a little Instagram account, which is called The Glorious Decline of the Officer's Library. And each day on Instagram, I've been putting up some of these little titles for people to enjoy that aren't here. But I put that one up, and somebody who I didn't know wrote me a message saying, that is the most read book of all the Navy books. So it was that's actually a really popular book, and I unfortunately didn't read it before I wrecked it.
Well, at least it probably is digitised then.
It probably is digitised, that one.
Well read.
Yeah. Yeah. But, you know, you guys who are so young, there's a lot of younger ones here. Do you even think about the First and Second World War anymore? I mean, do you know what any of these titles refer to? Or is it just like, I don't know what this is really about?
We're always taught...
Can you speak up just a bit?
Sorry. We're taught a lot about this in school.
Yeah.
At school, they try to teach it not from just the Australian perspective. They try and give you perspective from the US, perspective from some of the Oriental countries involved, even though it's... In some cases, not directly, but you learn like the parallel timelines to what's going on. And it is vitally important, I think, that everyone continues to like learn about not just First World War and Second World War. There's many other slightly more recent conflicts in that period, like any goings on in China and Cambodia,
Vietnam,
to do with the Korean Peninsula and things like this that have a very important to understand contextually, because it gives you context on the world that you're going into and going forward into. And I think books I also really like to read and I love books, and I think there is something really important about having a physical memento of the, like, a physical, like, keystone of that event that you have casually to hold, like, you're holding the information in your hand. Like, I think so much is online these days that lots of information just gets lost in a sea of information, whereas if you pick a book off a shelf,
this
little tome of history just right there, everything that you need to know from whatever perspective it's written or whatever, like, compilation of facts, it's where it's from, it's like you've got it there in front of you, rather than like this sort of detached and there's something impersonal about devices as well, like they can be very impersonal. So when you have a book and it's, you own it, or
it's personal,
personal. I was writing a history essay last semester, and it was about, part of the history of it was about the various revolutions and the Great Leap Forward in China, and so through that period right up until 1989 with Tiananmen Square. And I was getting all these books out from the history section, and I pulled out three books that were relevant to my essay, and they had not been opened.
Yeah.
Like, they were about this, and this wasn't like an unknown event either. Like, these are some big things in history. And it was just not touched. It was not open, but it was really old, so it was really weird to pull this book.
Some of these books had not, they had a library thing in them with the date, the last time they'd been taken out, and I was shocked too. They were like 1978.
And then you look at that going,
no one's reading, no one's getting this information,
So I think, but then it's a bit of like a cycle as well, because if people aren't educated about this, like, through a school system or through a university system, they may not know what they're missing, if that makes sense. Like, they may not know what they're not being enabled to see in history.
Yep.
And so they don't know to go and pick up that book, or they don't know to go and look up this, which I think, for me, is the most thing that I'm worried about. I'm worried about people forgetting that these are still very relevant in our context, and you must understand that we need to understand these events in order to prevent them from happening again in the future, which is, seems to be humanity's greatest downfall, is the repetition of the events that occur here.
A forgetting and what we choose to forget, and then what we choose to remember. Yeah. I think the fact, like, at the moment there's a 4-year historical thing happening all across Australia where everybody is memorialising the First World War. So from 1914 to 1918. And so 4 years ago there was lots of exhibitions happening, and the Anzac Centre down in Albany's opened, and there's been all kinds of different exhibitions, and now it's finishing. November the 11th will be the last of this year. So there's been a big focus on the First World War, which has been great. And I've just lost what I was going to say then. I don't know, if we didn't have that, if we didn't have the government investing that money, then maybe we wouldn't have had some of that stuff happen. And we've got to ask our governments to keep on prioritising letting people have history, right? But also that art can incorporate history as well. A lot of my paintings are, I would say, art for art's sake. They're abstract. My personal joy in painting. You can have a look on my website if you want to have a look at some of them. But I also think sometimes history is also incredibly crucial in art. You know, you can always it always incorporates some kind of history. Don't you agree, Mark? Whatever artwork it is, it's never empty of history. It's never empty of the contemporary space it's in at the time. And maybe part of our time is forgetting, you know, because we don't have the book so readily. If you're talking to someone, you go, there's this great story I heard about the war, you know, this war. You know, like, for instance, doing this, I heard about the Russian war, right, which I didn't have much knowledge about, and I was shocked. More people died in Russia in the Second World War than the whole of all these countries that we're talking about here.
The Battle of Stalingrad.
So many people died, and lots of women fought on the front in Russia, and yet we don't really hear about that story at all. It's always about the Americans coming in, saving us from the Germans and the Japanese, right?
That's a big thing as well. Like, I get really cross when I hear constantly about, like, the US coming into things like the Second World War, when, like, there were so many countries involved in that conflict. And like, I know everyone, you know, really has issues with Russia, but you gotta feel bad for the.
Yeah, you got to feel bad for the Russians, pretty much.
Because that was and they really did use, like, women were their primary snipers.
Yeah.
And they were very effective, like, they had units of women who would be their most effective.
So can I ask you, you're obviously really, like, interested. Are you able to incorporate that into your work at all?
I
Not that you have to, because it's taken me many, many years to do it, so it doesn't have to, you don't have to do it, you don't want to force it, but are you?
I would really like to. I often include in sort of my inspiration for various things in art that are from history, but history is very important to me. I think it's very important. So I would like to make work that has some link, even if it's not to do with war, just some link to something in history that I have read or have found important. I can never let that go, like, no matter what I'm doing. There's always...
Yeah, I mean, you've got to think creatively about it. I saw this fantastic work, which inspired me too, a German artist, I'm sorry I've forgotten his name, but he found in Berlin, just outside of Berlin, almost like a shepherd's hut, right? This old weatherboard hut. And apparently that had been Hitler's loge. Now, I don't know what a loge is, but I think it's a hunting place where you go and camp out and hunt. And it had just been left there to rot away, but it had a history. It was called Hitler's Loge. It was going to be demolished, so he got it all and he brought it into a gallery and he had it as an installation in the gallery. And it was just a pile of old wood and tin, right? But what made that so incredible was the title, you know, and the fact that it was really Hitler's Loge. It was actually connected to Hitler. So looking at this pile of junk, it wasn't just a sort of abstract sculpture, it was actually had a deeper meaning that was kind of, I don't know, gave it some gravitas, I guess. So, you know, you can work in all different ways. Yeah, with history, but I guess don't kill it, you know. So you don't want to, got to be careful that history doesn't become boring. And we can do that by just quoting facts. I think like any history is interesting if people can identify in a bodily way as human beings with what happened. That for me is what works. Yeah.
So, this is good. Yep. I remember Brendan Nelson sort of standing here like three years ago, and there was some work by Ben Quilty and Sean Gladwell.
Yeah.
Their works had interacted with you know, that means working as Australian war artists and interacting with soldiers.
Yep.
And this work has got an interaction, I suppose, as well. So, and I'm interested to know whether or not you're hopeful that this work will be shown to that audience, or whether or not you've already had them come in and have a look from.
It's on the 9th, which is the Remembrance Day event. There will be a flag-raising thing and wreath laying out here, and then people will come in here. And the exhibition will be officially opened by Bob Trotter, who's the president of the Submarine Association of Australia. So he hopefully has sent out an invitation to all the submariners to come and have a look. It'll be interesting to see what they think. But I think it's generally more... it's for a general public... You know, really. I don't know what's going to happen to it when it finishes. I need to find someone who has got a 15-metre long wall that would like it. It would be good to keep it, because otherwise it's just going to come and sit in my hallway again. But I don't know what the lifespan is. I mean, it's been stuck on with liquid nails, so hopefully it will last a bit longer. It took a lot of work to clean each book up. Like, I had to glue a lot of the these sort of old pieces of paper, and this had to be re-glued. So I've actually invested a lot into these old books. I don't really want them to go to landfill, but I really don't know what's going to happen to this work. I guess as an artist, you never know what's going to happen. You just put it out there and hopefully something will happen. This is a much more of a temporal work, and could probably be, I can probably take that somewhere else, which will be good. I'd love to show that again, that one. I don't know, you know, it works on its own without these books. But yeah.
So effectively, this is like a memorial to the sunken submarine. I mean, is there possibly something that the Australian military in one of the sort of historical war memorial museums? Is there
I have approached the RSL and other people to about it, and I just need to sweet talk them into taking it somehow. Yeah. Or, you know, someone else that's got a long wall somewhere. I think the Navy Club in Fremantle, David, that might. I think it's only 13 metres long, though, that wall. Yeah. Anyone else?
Do you start with the scrapbooks? Like, do you... Because me and my friend were doing this project, we'd get old books out of, whether it was Skips or just the $2 racket.
Yeah.
Elizabeth's. And... pretty much got them and rebind them in sketchbooks, and I started collecting just my favourite pages out of each one of those and then putting them into another journal.
Yep.
Do you end up doing that with any of those?
When I took those, I've actually got about 1,000 of those of pages and illustrations and things from these books. Yeah, they were just too good to throw out, and hope one day I might better. You know, I kind of, with this, I vetted them so that they were mostly the front pieces. There's one in the middle that where someone has written, you know, Kiss a Sailor, very important to Kiss a Sailor. So I thought that was a perfect one for this installation. But I could cover many a wall with the books, with the, just the pages that I've kept. Yeah. Yeah, they're beautiful, aren't they?
Yeah. Would you rebind them into, like, an actual other book that's...
I don't know, I haven't got that far yet. That would be something nice to do. But I'm more interested in making, I guess, some 2D things that people can look at rather than books. But it's a good idea. Yeah, you keep going with that. I mean, that's a whole strand of making, isn't it? That's a very personal way of looking at them too, when people have to engage with an artist's book. I just think for this exhibition I wanted to be pretty loud with them and try and get as many of them up here to talk. That repetition talks about a huger loss than perhaps a small, you know, a book where you're talking about a personal loss or a much more private view. Yeah.
Are you in next year's high tide?
No. I don't even know if next year's high tide's going to happen. Is it? Oh, okay. Oh, are you in it?
Maybe.
Oh, good. It's a great, great festival to be in. Yeah. Any other questions, or is that it? Yeah. I don't mind. Oh, well, thank you. Thanks for coming along.